We're going to continue our studies now in Mastering the English Bible, the Old Testament. And we come to the Babylonian captivity and the period from then to the then until the return to the coming of Jesus, and including this 400 silent years, it's called, between the last prophet Malachi and the birth of Jesus. And so we have the text of this in the new textbook that we printed out, Babylonian Captivity to Esther. And so we're going to probably in this meeting this week finish the history of the Old Testament. That's the history of the Old Testament, which is Genesis through 2 Kings. 1 and 2 Chronicles covers the same history as 1 and 2 Kings. And so the history of the Bible is from Genesis to 2 Kings. And everything else fits into that somewhere. Well, that's not exactly true. We have also Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. And then the prophets, they wrote either during the kingdom or during Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther era. And the Job and Psalms and Proverbs, they were all written during the kingdom. And so the actual history goes through Esther, which is what we're studying. And we're going to cover now the Babylonian captivity, particularly Jeremiah and the English. We're going to cover the Babylonian captivity, Jeremiah and the Jewish exiles to Egypt. The Bible gives us quite a bit of this history, so it must be important. And then Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon, where Daniel lived. Daniel in Babylon, and then Ezekiel's life in Babylon. And this covers the biblical side of what was happening during those 70 years. And then Ezra, the building of the second temple. Nehemiah, the building of the walls. As they came back, Babylonians had destroyed the city. They had to rebuild it. And we have that account in Ezra and Nehemiah. And then Esther, and the amazing account of how that God saved the Jews from destruction during the Persian Empire. And so, more history. But all of this is for today. None of this is old. I thought when I was a kid, I thought the Bible was just an old book about old things that had nothing to do with my life. And how wrong I was. But you can't go back. You've got to go forwards. We need to teach our children how practical the Bible is. The man that led me to Christ, the first man I actually met that understood the practicality of the Bible. And I met him. I was practicing Hinduism, basically, at the time, hitchhiking. And I picked him up in my car. And so I started talking about God. I said, you believe in God? He said, yeah. He said, I do. I pulled a Bible out of his pocket. And I said, well, I started talking to him about reincarnation and stuff. And he could take the Bible and answer me exactly whatever I was thinking. He could answer me from the Bible. And I was amazed that the Bible was that practical, that the Bible had anything to do with my life. And that's one reason I stayed with the man and let him keep talking to me. But the Bible is very practical. So we're going to hit the highlights of the textbook, but most of these studies are going to be done with the pictorial Bible. And again, we would remind the students that we must to get the most out of this course. And a massive amount of work, 50 years of work, has gone into the production of this course. But to get the most out of it, you have to go through the textbook, many of the things we skipped over, and then answer the review questions. And we will be sending the review questions for this section. And then take the test. And then go back and find the answers through the questions that you missed. We don't, as Bible believers, we don't take tests to pass tests. We take tests for our life. In Nepal, the educational system is very weak, and the passing grade is, I think, 35%. Now, that's pretty bad. If you know 35% of something, you know nothing. But for doctors there, it's 50%. And nurses and pharmacists. Can you imagine going to a doctor who passed with 50%? And you just hope he knows it was that 50% you need. No, that's the world. Of course, that's a pathetic part of the world, a weak part of the world. But we are doing something entirely different. We're God's people. We're learning the Bible. We're learning about God. We're learning about God's ways. We're learning eternal things. And so really the aim needs to be 100%. 100%. In our Bible college, the passing grade is 70%. But that's not enough. Unless that's the very best you can do. But if it's not the very best you can do, it's certainly not enough. 70%. We need to aim high. And so that's how to get the most out of this course. Study the Bible, not for tests, but for life. And so, we're going to go to the pictorial Bible now, again. The Babylonian captivity. We want to continue the studies, these historical studies in the pictorial Bible. And so we come to the Babylonian captivity. We saw how that Jerusalem was destroyed by the Babylonians. And them that had escaped from the sword carried he away to Babylon, he, Nebuchadnezzar, where they were servants to him and his sons until the reign of the kingdom of Persia. Indeed, 70 years. So here's the journey from Judea, Jerusalem, all the way up. They didn't go straight across because that's all desert. And the route they went and the way that the major roads were, they followed the major roads, which was up almost to the Euphrates and down along the Euphrates to Babylon. It's about 1,500 miles. They were not driving in a car. They were walking. Journey would have been brutal. Large numbers of people would have perished. The Jews would have perished. Along the way, I mean, these Babylonian soldiers that were transporting them didn't care if they lived or died. So it would have been a horrible journey. Just the journey itself. Those that had survived the slaughter when the Babylonians conquered Jerusalem. And they had to travel that 1,500 miles. The Babylonian soldiers were not kind and gentle, and they didn't like the Jews. So it would have been a very terrible trip. And so through Jeremiah, God instructed those Jews how to live at this time. God continued to be kind to Israel, even in their apostate condition. And he said, "Thus saith the Lord, that after 70 years be accomplished at Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good word toward you in causing you to return to this place." God said, "You'll return. You'll come back to Jerusalem after 70 years. So what now, Lord? Well, build ye houses and dwell in them, and plant gardens and eat the fruit of them. Take ye wives and beget sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters to husbands, that they may bear sons and daughters, that you may be increased there and not diminished. And seek the peace of the city, whither I've caused you to be carried away captives, and pray unto the Lord for it. For in the peace thereof shall you have peace." There again is the emphasis on prayer. It had the prayer, their prayers, and whether they prayed or not, would have much to do with how their condition was going to be in Babylon. Prayer is very, very important. The Jewish people survived because God touched the hearts of the Babylonians. The policy allowed the Jews to settle in towns and villages along the Chebar River, which is mentioned in Ezekiel. And that was a man-made river, an irrigation channel that connected two parts of the Euphrates River, starting there by Babylon and going down. The river was flowing south and going down south and reconnecting again with the Euphrates. That is the river Chebar. Here's another view of that close up. And so it began just a little bit north of Babylon and flowed down. This is a major man-made canal. And then flowed down near Ur of the Chaldees, where Abraham was from. Here it is today. It's still there. And it was carved through that rock. It was a major engineering feat of that day. So the Jews were allowed to live together in communities and allowed to work and basically live their lives. And so back in Jerusalem, Jeremiah was still there. And he had lived in Jerusalem until it was destroyed. After that, he was taken up to Ramah. So there's Jerusalem. Ramah is just a short distance north. Ramah, a major part of this course is to learn to take Bible geography more seriously. Study these details. And the pictorial Bible, we study these in great detail using many different maps. And so Jeremiah was taken up to Ramah with the captives. And that's where Hannah had lived. That's where Samuel had his headquarters, as we saw earlier in the Judges. And at Ramah, Nebuchadnezzar had set up his camp, and he was judging things, deciding what was going to happen to the Jews. And Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, released Jeremiah and gave him freedom to go wherever he pleased. So Jeremiah could have gone anywhere. He was offered an income. But he decided to stay with the Jews, in spite of how the Jews had terribly mistreated him. So he went to join with Gedaliah, who was now the head of the Jews, and his headquarters was up in Mizpah, Jeremiah 46 and 7. So he's going north again. He's there with the remnant of the Jews. The captains of the Jewish forces that had escaped the Babylonians gathered, congregated up in Mizpah. The little groups of forces that had not been conquered, captured. Jehonan was one of the captains. He's named in the Bible. But he warned Gedaliah that Ishmael planned to kill him at the instigation of Balas, who was the king of the Ammonites, and the Ammonites were over east of Jordan. Ishmael, he was of the royal seed, so he probably thought that he could be the king of Israel. Gedaliah, he was gullible. He was lacking in wisdom. He was warned by a warrior, "This man's going to kill you." And Gedaliah said, "Oh, don't talk to me about that. That's negative. I don't want to hear that." He didn't even check it out to see if it's true. Ishmael was a liar, a murderer, and a rebel. The warning was absolutely true. And so he came to Mizpah with 10 other men, pretending to be a friend. And he had plotted the destruction of Gedaliah. So he came there and he ate Gedaliah's food, and then he killed him. That was the kind of man that Ishmael was. Exactly what Gedaliah was warned about. He should have listened. And so Ishmael took captive the people, still alive in Mizpah, including Jeremiah. And he's going to head over to Ammon, over in the east, across the Jordan. But he was intercepted at the great waters of Gibeon by Johanan, and the other captives, the warriors, the soldiers, and they were able to recover Jeremiah and those other people at the great waters that are in Gibeon. And that refers to that pool where the soldiers of Abner and Moab had killed one another back in 2 Samuel 2, which was a very stupid thing, but they did it. 2 Samuel 2, this is that pool. Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon, and Joab, the son of Zeruiah, the servants of David, went out and met together by the pool of Gibeon. The pool of Gibeon, or the waters of Gibeon. Then there arose and went over by number 12 of Benjamin. 12 men of Benjamin, which pertained to Ishbosheth, son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. So 12 soldiers from each side. And they caught everyone, his fellow, by the head, and thrust his sword in his fellow's side. So they fell down together. They killed each other. All 24 died there in that same place, the pool of Gibeon. It was discovered in the 1950s. Most of these things were lost for thousands of years. Their location was lost and have been rediscovered in modern times. And it's there. Big shaft goes down to 82 feet. Vertical shaft, but there's a stairway around the edge of it. Great feat of engineering. And that was called one of the top 10 discoveries in biblical archaeology. So Johanan asked Jeremiah to pray to God for wisdom. Well, what should we do? Jeremiah, you seek the will of God for us. Whatever God says, we will do it. It sounded so great. You can't believe what people say. You've got to believe what they do. People can sound so pious. They had no intention to obey God. None at all. God commanded people to remain there and not go to Egypt. That's what God said to Jeremiah. He promised to bless them there. He said, don't go to Egypt. I'll bless you. I'll protect you from Nebuchadnezzar. Don't go to Egypt. Don't go to Egypt. If you go to Egypt, I'll judge you myself. But the Bible says they were all proud men. That's the problem. Pride. That's the problem. That's man's root problem. And so in spite of everything that they had seen, in spite of the fact that Jeremiah had always been proven to be the true prophet, they decided, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. We're going to Jerusalem. And Jeremiah, obviously God led him, decided to go with him. Stayed with them. Apparently he died down there. This is the end of the biblical record. We don't know any more about it. So they left Gibeon. They traveled down to Egypt, the Nile Desert, to Tahpanhes. Old Jeremiah going down with these rebel Jews. They settled in Tahpanhes in the Nile Delta. Pharaoh had a palace there. And they settled in Migdol and Migdol up in the Nile Delta also. And Noph, which is Memphis. And Pathros, which is down south. Which is also upper Egypt, but south Egypt. So there in Tahpanhes, Jeremiah prophesied that Nebuchadnezzar was going to conquer Egypt and set up his throne at the entry of Pharaoh's palace there. Great prophecy, Jeremiah 43. And that God was going to break the idols, images, Beth Shemesh, that is in the land of Egypt. House of the sun, they were sun worshipers. Sun worship. This is a reconstructed drawing of Heliopolis, Heliopolis' house of the sun. The temple of the sun, the ray god of Egypt. This is a reconstructed drawing. They had fantastic temples and palaces. Here's the ruins today of Hierapolis. Hierapolis. Sun. Worship of the sun. So, in the 19th century, the Bible critics said, no, this never happened. Nebuchadnezzar did not invade Egypt because we don't know anything about that outside of the Bible. And since they don't believe the Bible, they said, no, it didn't happen. But they found later a clay tablet that says, in the 37th year of Nebuchadnezzar, king of the country of Babylon, he went to Egypt to make war. Amasis, king of Egypt, collected his army and marched and spread abroad. And so there was a tablet confirming what Jeremiah said would happen. Nebuchadnezzar did invade Egypt. God gave a sign that Pharaoh, Hophra, would be given into the hands of his enemies, Jeremiah 44:30. And Herodotus, the Greek historian, said that that's exactly what happened. And so God then delivered a strong message to the Jewish exiles. He rebuked their idolatry. He promised to judge them. All of this through the prophet Jeremiah. They had seen the destruction of their great city and temple, and yet they still would not obey God. He said, I will punish them that dwell in the land of Egypt as I have punished Jerusalem by the sword, by the famine, and by the pestilence. And so this is their reply to God. As for the word that thou hast spoken unto us in the name of the Lord, we will not hearken unto thee. But we will certainly do whatsoever thing goeth forth out of our own mouth, to burn incense unto the queen of heaven, and to pour out drink offerings unto her. We will do it. We will worship the queen of heaven. We will. We will not obey the Lord. That's very brazen. And the goddess, the mother goddess, originated back in Babylon, the Tower of Babel. She was called the Queen of Heaven, the Mother of God. Had many names like Astarte and Tammuz, Isis and Horus, and other names. Tike and Child. Tike, the goddess of luck, good luck. That she was known as the Mother of the Gods, the Queen of Heaven, and that's where Mariolatry came from in the Roman Catholic Church. Through all of that, Christianized by the Roman Catholic Church and became the Madonna worship. And they patterned those Madonnas exactly after the ancient goddess statues. This looks like Isis here with Horus, but it's Mary and Jesus. And they gave, and the Roman Catholic Church gave Mary the name Queen of Heaven. And they invented the false teaching that Mary had no sin. And that Mary ascended up to heaven and she's ruler as the Queen of Heaven up there with Jesus. And she answers prayer and she helps sinners. In 1935, Pope Pius XI officially gave Mary the name Co-Redemptrix, Co-Redeemer. And so Mary is the central figure in Catholic churches all over the world, this false Mary. The major Mary church in the world is in Rome. The major Mary Basilica, that's what it's called. And up on the roof, on the ceiling, is Mary sitting with Jesus in his throne, and he is crowning her the Queen of Heaven. And there in that church, Mary is depicted as the Queen of Peace. Queen of Peace. All of this is blasphemous. Christ is the Prince of Peace, but there is no Queen of Peace. And outside of that church is this crucifix, this huge crucifix, with Jesus hanging on one side of the cross and Mary hanging on the other side. And I took all of these photos. And so that's Jeremiah back in Egypt. And they say, we're not going to obey God. We're going to worship the Queen of Heaven. Nobody's going to stop to us. And that's the last time we see Jeremiah in the Bible. And he had to stand alone. He was alone as far as we know. most of the time, through most of his ministry, Jeremiah was alone. And he stood. He stood for God. His call to repentance was rejected. And so Israel went into captivity. And Israel has been really under judgment for the last 2,400 years since then. But Jeremiah prophesied of the new covenant that God's going to make with Israel. And that is in the future. God's going to save Israel. God's going to open Israel's eyes and give them new life. Daniel said, "They that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament. And they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever." And God, and Jeremiah will be there. He'll be there with Daniel, with all the other old saints. And so the Jews were taken captive to Babylon. Oh, what a magnificent city it was at that time. It was the greatest city on earth. There's probably never been anything since then to equal the Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar's day. Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar's empire stretched all the way across that part of the world, covering all the territory that the Assyrians had, plus more. Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold in the prophecy of Daniel 2. Daniel had the vision. Nebuchadnezzar had the dream of a giant image of a man. That gold, its gold was, its head was gold and its breast was silver and its thighs were brass. And its legs were of iron and its feet of iron and clay mixed together. So it had feet of clay. And Nebuchadnezzar's father, Nebuchadnezzar, had founded the Neo-Babylonian Empire, it's called in history. And that empire ruled the world for about, that part of the world, for about 100 years. Here's Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar. And an image of him over on the left. Nebuchadnezzar. That's Nebuchadnezzar's father. Here's a clay tablet. And it describes the work on the walls of Babylon, the famous walls of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar's day, and it was completed by Nebuchadnezzar, his son. He died in 605, and Nebuchadnezzar came to the throne of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. And again, the skeptics in the 19th century, they said, no, there wasn't Nebuchadnezzar. That's just something in the Bible. But they began to find a lot of bricks with his name on it. Thousands of them. Hundreds of thousands of them. Here's one in the British Museum. Or no, this one's in the Oriel Institute in Chicago. This one has a stamp. And it says, Nebuchadnezzar, King of Babylon, the British Museum. This one has the words, Nebuchadnezzar, King of Babylon, who cares for Esagila and Ezida. And those were Babylonian temples. Nebuchadnezzar, eldest son of Nebuchadnezzar, King of Babylon. And so all these discoveries disprove the Bible critics. But the Bible critics never apologize. They just go on and keep criticizing something else. Bible critics have been refuted thousands of times. It's almost laughable at how wrong, how consistently wrong they are. Here is Nebuchadnezzar. This is an image of Nebuchadnezzar depicted as a mighty hunter, going back to Nimrod. Nimrod, the mighty hunter, he was the original founder of Babylon. And so the German Oriental Institute, the German Oriental Society did tremendous excavations in Babylon. And they confirmed that indeed the Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar's day was a magnificent city. We read about it in Daniel 4. The king spake and said, "Is not this great Babylon? that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power, for the honor of my majesty. Braggadocious man, as all those ancient kings were. Oh, he's talking about a great city, and it was. Here's an image of Nebuchadnezzar dating to 585 BC, which is the year after the destruction of Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar. That's in the Florence Museum. Magnificent city. This is an artist reconstruction based on archaeological findings. It was a great center of international commerce. And they actually set the prices, exchange rates for all the commercial activity that was going on across the kingdom. These are weights discovered at Babylon. Beautiful weights that they use for commerce. Babylon was right on the Euphrates. They had a harbor. Boats and ships went up and down. The Bible closely associates Babylon with covetousness. America's a modern Babylon. Mortify your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry. That was Babylon. All of that. The goods flowed. They had caravans and oxen caravans down in the deserts, the camels. And they had ships, the busy docks at Babylon on the Euphrates River. And they would transport things as far as the India, modern India, Pakistan. It was called the Indus Civilization, but they would ship things over to Babylon and ship things from Babylon over there and also down south in Africa. The streets were broad and straight, just like Rome. They liked straight, broad streets. The walls are famous in history. According to the Greek historian Herodotus, the walls were 56 miles long, at least 50 feet high. That's five-story walls. They were magnificent. The outer wall was about 80 feet wide, and two chariots drawn by four horses could pass each other on the road along that road on top of the wall. It's magnificent walls. And beyond the walls was a deep moat. Deep moat. And so there's the Euphrates running through, it ran through Babylon, and there's its moats and its walls. There were many gates. The most famous gate was the Ishtar gate. Ishtar, the goddess. And that was discovered by the Germans, all broken to pieces. That gate, little pieces. It was a double gate. They had a small gate in front and then a larger gate in behind there. And the Germans took those broken pieces back to Berlin and reconstructed the thing. And now it's in the Pergamon Museum. And I got there real early one morning and ran in there. I was the first person before anyone got in there to block my picture and took this photograph of the. That's exactly what Daniel would have seen. Reconstructed Ishtar Gate. Here's the Germans piecing that thing together. Magnificent piece of work that they did. The gate was named for the goddess Ishtar. This was her symbol, the lion. And they had her image on that gate and all down along the road leading to the gate. And also the god Adad or Baal. And his image is a bull. And Marduk, the god Marduk, who was a dragon. And all these were Babylonian idols. They had a central doorway. that led to the king's throne room, which was right by the gate. The throne room was 170 by 56 feet. That's where Daniel sat. The Bible said Daniel sat in the gate here. Daniel sat in the gate. So here's a reconstructive drawing of the entrance to the throne room where Daniel sat. And it was a part of that Ishtar Gate complex. The throne room was a part of that complex. The Ishtar Gate led to the Tower of Babel, which is up top of this upper right hand of this drawing. So there's the Ishtar Gate over on the left, the broad highway leading up through Babylon, and then the Tower of Babel there. Here's a reconstructive drawing of Nebuchadnezzar's throne room. That's where Daniel sat. And so leading to the gate was this causeway, the processional way. These are the things Daniel would have seen every day. And it was at least 50 feet wide, 750 feet long, and paved with these beautiful white limestone blocks and some colored blocks on the side. And all those blocks were inscribed with the words, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, the street for the procession of the great Lord Marduk, I decorated magnificently with stones from the mountains. Marduk, my Lord, give eternal life. That was Marduk. That was Nebuchadnezzar's faith before he got saved. I believe he got saved. And so the processional way, part of that has been also reconstructed in Berlin. But it had the images of the lions, the Ishtar, the goddess Ishtar, all along the way. So they would use this in the religious festivals, military processions. Nebuchadnezzar built a grand palace made of marble and all kinds of amazing materials and beautiful things. He called it my shining residence. So here it is, the Ishtar Gate, the Tower of Babel, city walls. That's a good reconstructive drawing there. He also built the Hanging Gardens as a gift to one of his wives. She was from the mountains, and she missed the mountains. And so he made her a man-made mountain. Artificial mountain, complete with forest and gardens. Must have been an incredible sight. This is an artistic rendering. So here's Nebuchadnezzar having a party up on his on top of the Hanging Gardens with the Tower of Babel in the background. And these are the kinds of things that Daniel would have seen every day. Diodorus, the Greek historian, said the gardens were 400 feet square, more than 80 feet high. So that would be 8 stories. Massive structure. And it was watered. There was running water that watered the whole thing and provided water for the gardens. And it was cleverly designed so the water did not crumble the structure. It was amazing. It had pumps that pumped the water up and so they could flow down by gravity through all of the gardens and trees. Exotic plants were brought there for Nebuchadnezzar's man-made mountain. Fountains and streams all through there. It must have been something. And again, the skeptics have doubted that, but there's a lot of evidence that the Hanging Gardens of Babylon actually existed. The famous Tower of Babel started right after the flood, not long after the flood, founded by Nimrod, as described in Genesis 11. And it was reconstructed by Nebuchadnezzar. So we're going to stop there. What time do we start? Right. for this session.